Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday morning. It's August 4th. Currently 57 degrees here in Old Town Park City under some hazy, smoky skies. 54 degrees in the Heber Valley with a similar situation. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch. Back on this Tuesday, we're going to be looking at mostly sunny skies, but we'll call it hazy sunshine out there for us as we get more of that smoke and haze from those wildfires to our north and west. Temperatures climbing into the mid-80s for highs in the Park City area. We'll see the high temperatures climbing into the low 90s in the Heber Valley. Overall, these temperatures still fairly comfortable for us today. As we go into your Wednesday, more or less the same forecast expected. Mostly sunny skies, but that hazy sunshine with more of that smoke and haze, all thanks to our wildfire threat that's going on up across the Pacific Northwest. High temperatures overall will be in the mid-80s again for Park City. We'll see those highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. We start to see some changes, though, as we go into your Thursday and Friday. That ridge of high pressure begins to slide back closer to the Beehive State. That'll bring in a surge of warmer air, so temperatures make their way back up into the low 90s for highs for your Friday and Saturday, or Thursday and Friday, I should say, across most of the Park City area. High temperatures will climb into the mid to upper 90s for us as we get towards the Heber Valley as we make our way into your Thursday and Friday. Now, once we get towards the weekend, again, we're going to be watching the heat peaking again across the area. So highs will be in the low to mid 90s in Park City for your Friday, Saturday, and into Sunday. We'll see those high temperatures around 100 to 102 degrees in the Heber Valley for your Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Again, overall dry conditions with mostly sunny skies, maybe a little haze from some of the wildfires, but otherwise no major weather issues expected. Now, as we head into early next week, we'll keep those temperatures on the warm side, upper 80s to near 90 in Park City. We'll be in the mid to upper 90s in the Heber Valley, but we'll start to introduce a few more clouds, and we'll also start to introduce at least a slight chance of an isolated thunderstorm or two popping up, particularly as we get towards early next week. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes. We'll be running through a number of the development projects going on in Summit County. Later on, Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybrow will preview Wednesday's County Council meeting with an update on some other topics. And from the Summit Land Conservancy, CEO Cheryl Fox in to discuss the newest open space acquisition as well as some of their upcoming events. On the phone now with an update from the Summit County Planning Office, I have Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Leslie. Hope you're well today.
Yeah, thank you. Well, let's start with the rezone process that's underway to make it a bit less expensive and onerous for developers to present an application to the planning department. You gave a presentation at the county council meeting last week about the potential changes to these rezoning rules. Maybe start by explaining how the proposal would or would not make it easier for developers to rezone.
Okay, so anyone who was paying attention last week would have been as thrilled as I was at the wonderful warm reception we received at the council, or I talk sarcastically because there was a lot of fear and angst in the room, some of which probably emanating were the various members of the public there. The process that we were bringing to the council is exactly that. It's actually a change to the process whereby how you apply for a rezone. It's changing the level of information required and the level of detail that's required to present before you can actually come to the, present an application right now, before you can come to the table and visit with the planning commission or the council. You'll a developer, anyone who's proposing a rezone, a private individual who wishes to adjust the zone on a small parcel of land to infill, has to create a level of detailed information that's unnecessary when you're asking the basic question, are we interested in adjusting the uses? It's like we have, there's essentially four different types of land use zoning. We would call it a functional zoning whereby you describe the uses that are allowed, an intensity zoning by how much you're allowed. form-based zoning, a relatively new one in the lexicon, about basically what shapes you're allowed, what the style of the building is going to be, and then an incentive zone whereby you get different zoning depending on a request that we want, whether it's open space or affordable housing. Our zones tend to mix and match all of those, and if someone wishes to come to the table, for example, in a rural residential zone, and propose, say, three small townhouses on an infill rural residential lot, it might make sense. It might be a perfectly, you know, level of scale. Obviously, we get much bigger, more complex projects than that. But at that level of application, in order to do that using the base rural residential zoning, you'd have to have a 60-acre parcel of land. So clearly, that's not necessarily feasible, and it's certainly not affordable. So if you wish to present a project like that, you'd have to rezone to a community commercial zone in order to get the required density and allowed use on that area. Community commercial zone would, of course, then trigger all sorts of concerns about whether you're going to build a gas station or some other, you know, commercial use that was unsuitable for the area. So the question is, how do we get to ask the question of the Planning Commission and Council whether or not a particular proposal is a good fit for either an existing zone or a proposed new zone? It doesn't make sense for anybody in terms of the effort, the energy, the money, the time, whether it's on behalf of the applicant, the property owner, or even staff review time. You're not even allowed to ask the question at Planning Commission or Council until you've created essentially a full set of working drawings. That is tremendously deep into the process. If someone is $100,000 worth of drawings into a process, or on a larger project, $500,000 or $1 million into the process, before they get in front of the Planning Commission for the first time for a public hearing and public input, then it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to convince that property owner to change project, because then they have to do that set of drawings all over again. What we're proposing to do is bring the public influence to a project via Planning Commission, public hearings, then eventually Council, earlier in the process, in order to get that input early and thereby impact the future design development of the project. We need to actually reduce the current standard that's in the code. The current standard requires meeting very, very specific technical standards. You don't need those at the early stage when you're simply asking a question. Is this a use that would fit in this area? It's currently zoned one zone. We need to change it to something else. In order to do that, can I just ask the question, is this a good idea or not? So the process we're doing is simply to be able to ask that question earlier. Your ability to influence, change a development for the better or a complete and outright denial, that influence needs to be brought forward earlier in the process, so the public and the public process can actually influence what happens on the site.
All right. So what we're saying is that you're trying to make it procedurally easier, and that saves yes. money. It doesn't lessen the requirements on the developer, because they have to, at the end of the day, still do everything that's required of them.
All of those standards will be required before anyone can pull a building permit. They all have to be satisfied. So it's as simple. The design, the cost, the development is still going to be expensive. It's still going to be extraordinarily difficult. The process itself, the bureaucracy, should not be the difficult part of the process.
So at the beginning of the rezone process, the developer sounds like only needs to agree with the county council on things like density, height, and kind of the general building layout. Some of the council members, though, thought that was too vague. So how are you going to address that?
If you look at any of the zoning districts we have, they typically, this is what a zone typically does in our code. We have a use table that describes the uses that are allowed in a zone. Each of the zones, they're very short paragraphs in the Snyderville Basin Development Code. It talks about the density, the number of units per acre or square footage requirement if it's commercial. It talks about the maximum height of buildings, the setback of buildings, and essentially not much else. So if I'm going to ask the question, can I put a project on a site, why do I actually have to ask a full set of technical questions? Show me the detailed cross-sections of the sewer district requirement. Show me the stormwater details and the road layouts and grading and curb heights. All of that information needs to be done later. The basic question, does it make sense to, say, put a residential use on a slightly higher density than allowed under the base zoning, but maybe it matches the existing zoning of the nearby neighborhood? Does that make sense in this area? Can I ask the question? And can't currently ask the question because the way the process is written, you have to answer all the technical questions before you can even make an application.
So if this saves money for developers, does a less expensive planning process make for a more affordable final product, or is it more for the developer's own margins here?
Well, it would. Hopefully, it would do both. What I'm trying to get at, and what I'm asking, I can't say trust me. I'm saying that the development process. If anyone has been through a design, if you were lucky enough to design your own home or was in any kind of design, the process takes time and it's flexible and it changes as you move through the process. And once you make a decision, you're fixing something, you know, with an assumed cost and time associated with developing it. If you have to fix all those decisions at the beginning, then the ability to influence change later becomes much more expensive, desperately time-consuming. It's expensive for the applicant. It's expensive for the county in terms of resources and energy and time. If you're spending $1 million to get an approval and 3 years to get there, the financing cost of that from a developer's perspective, if part of the object of the exercise is to reduce the cost of housing, say, for an affordable housing project, that is going to be out of reach simply because of the processing time and the amount of money spent in getting to the end goal, whether you can have an approval. You still have to build the project. You still have to do the engineering. You still have to meet all those technical standards. But just to get to the yes or no decision has cost serious amounts of money.
All right, so the change is being proposed now primarily because of the Klein-Dolly project, but it would apply to other developments in the Snyderville Basin. Have you heard from developers besides Columbus Pacific who might benefit from this change?
Not specifically. I'm not going to challenge you on the statement that it was done primarily for Klein-Dolly. It was just that when we released the RFP for Klein-Dolly and we described the vision for the site, it was clear that none of the existing zones that we have would actually allow the project to be built as we described it. So if you wanted that kind of mixed-use development with a small lot, affordable housing component and some other housing, attainable housing associated with it, none of our zones would actually allow that to take place. So we need to create a new zone. Once you've created the new zone, obviously, that's one part of the exercise. You also have to go through the process of applying for the zone. So we're starting off with, let's make the process to apply easier. Or shall we say less onerous and less time consuming. We still need to create the zone which you can apply for that would allow this project to take place. So Klein-Dolly was the trigger because we as development partners were the owners of the property. It would also reflect on how we would apply for other projects that the county's trying to do, but also because it's supposed to be a fairer process and allow the public influence to have an impact earlier in the process, it would also apply to everybody else. So every project would get earlier opportunities for public impact to the project and influence, hopefully for the better, but if necessary, a flat-out denial. We can do that quickly without wasting anybody's time.
All right. When do you expect the Planning Commission and the County Council to consider adopting any amendments?
The Planning Commission actually approved the process unanimously on June the 9th. The council, based on the conversation we had last week, we've advertised and we're aiming for an August 19th public hearing. We're going to be deciding this morning whether it's going to be possible for us to meet that deadline with the clearly there was something missing in the explanation from staff's perspective. We made an assumption about people understood what we were doing. That was clearly a mistake on our part. So we need to do some an exercise in education. Our trick is, can we get, say, a work session in council and the public hearing on the same day? Or maybe we need to bring some more education materials to the table first. But we're currently targeting August the 19th. I'd like to hit that deadline. One of the complications in this exercise was that in between the Planning Commission approval and the meeting we had last week, there were two stories in the media that were related to projects that we as the County Planning Department have no involvement in and had no discussion, not seen an application. And that was a proposal for a housing development discussed at the school board in Trailside and another mixed-use housing development on Rasmussen Road that was discussed at the Housing Authority. And you and I, think, briefly talked about it the last time we spoke, Leslie. We have not received formal applications or even inquiries as to those projects. So I believe many members of the public, especially the Trailside community, may have been of the mistaken belief that the reason why we were changing the code is to allow or permit the Trailside development, for example. That is not the case. That's a separate conversation going on between landowners and, you know, public bodies discussing what their dreams and wants for their site. They would still have to go through a process, and we haven't had any communication with those people.
Okay, moving on. What's the latest with the Browns Canyon Ivory Home proposal? It sounded like there was some kind of meeting Thursday.
There is the first public hearing on the proposal is actually this Thursday at the Eastern Planning Commission in Camas. They've had several work sessions. We were trying to make sure that the public hearing was actually taking place in Camas. We decided that it's the South Summit School District area. That's where the bulk of the population live by. So we're going to have the first public hearing there. Maybe a decision will come out of that meeting at that time. Maybe not, and we'll have to have a subsequent meeting. But that's the first time the public will actually get to speak in a meeting directly to the Planning Commission.
So what are the biggest issues that staff is evaluating here with this project?
Well, clearly, what they're actually trying to do at the moment is another one of those little complicated exercises. They're trying to create a zone. Having created the zone, they will then have to go through the application to apply for the zone. But the zone they're trying to create, one of the issues is, from our perspective, and I believe that's been reflected by comments from the Planning Commission, there's a degree of vagueness to the zone. That there's a kind of a lack of clarity in what it is we want. It's kind of the opposite extreme to where we are in the Snyderville Basin, where you're required to provide all the engineering drawings up front. On this zone proposal, basically it's a giant master plan, glorified bubble diagram with some statements made, and there's a lack of detail. The issue in any development on the east side is infrastructure, water and wastewater provision being the two critical ones. And should we, for example, be approving a zone on the promise that, well, we have paper water rights, but we haven't drilled any wells yet? So those questions have been floating backwards and forwards. The Planning Commission laid out a sequence of direct concerns that they had. Hopefully, when we go back on Thursday, the applicant will have some answers or not, and then, you know, it will be open to the public to express their concerns about this particular development.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, I mean, roads, water, sewer, emergency services, all of that. Do you anticipate some PIDs, public infrastructure districts, being proposed here?
I can imagine if this actually became a real proposal, then every financing tool that's available to any kind of developer would be on the table, because this is going to be an extraordinarily expensive and complex piece of work should it come to fruition. I'm not cynical, I'm skeptical about, you know, asking the questions, but obviously there's going to be serious financing questions brought into play.
All right. Earlier this year, the proposed preliminary municipality in Browns Canyon didn't move forward with the state of Utah. Can you tell us where that stands today? I mean, has the lieutenant governor accepted the preliminary municipality from Ivory Homes now that the Bear Canyon preliminary municipality in Wasatch County is off the table?
I can't actually answer that question directly. I don't have the knowledge. My understanding is that the way the state code works is that they will accept two applications per year. It doesn't say if one of the applications, having gone through 8 months of study, that is finally rejected, then we just pick the next one on in the queue and start renewing that one. I believe that nothing will happen until next year. I don't know that for a fact. That's just my assumption. I believe that the project that was rejected having gone through a period of analysis and study. I don't think they commit resources in addition and continuously so that we'll just pull the next application down. I think we have to start the process all over again next year if the law still exists in its current form next year.
All right, yeah, because I think Wasatch County leaders would like to see this pilot program disbanded, just saying it's just not doing what it was intended to do. Are Summit County officials coordinating with the state on any of these concerns as well?
I'm not sure we if we have any direct concerns other than those we've expressed already. The concerns that others have raised are valid and well known. The original law actually came into place with a sunset clause on it. Our concerns have been raised in the past and no doubt will be raised in the future should one of these projects come back in front of us, because we actually do get to have a comment on anything that's proposed in our area, but it's a state process, not a county process. The concerns should be clear and obvious to anyone who studied it. If the intent was to try and create opportunities for affordable housing, for example, I'm not sure if it's done that. In fact, I'm going to say I'm very sure it's not done that. I think there are other tools available, and building a town is a very complex, difficult exercise, and a simple law the way it was written. There are no simple solutions to complex and difficult problems.
And finally, there's been ongoing discussion about providing future access to Canyons Village via Red Pine Road. I guess, where do those discussions today land?
That's actually a development agreement amendment. The Canyons Development Agreement actually has a limitation. There's an assumption that there will be a future development of Red Pine, above the canyons there. And there will be an access road, necessary access road for servicing, deliveries. Fire access is the big question that crops up. But the Canyons Development Agreement in its initial stages, the vision was that private vehicles would not be continuously driving up down that road, and the primary access would be via gondola, alternative means, et cetera, transportation systems, and it would not be, a popular route for private vehicles. That was written into the development agreement as a restriction. The applicant came in front of the Planning Commission and spent several meetings in front of the Planning Commission requesting that DA be changed. The chief reasoning is that the fire district has actually come back and said, we need an evacuation plan, and that evacuation plan needs to include the provision for private vehicles to drive down that road. So that was their premise. The Planning Commission took a long, hard look at it, and in the end, last week, they actually forwarded a negative recommendation to the council to change the DA. I don't know if it was prejudice against the private cars in particular, but it was the knock-on impacts of, if we allow this, then what are the consequences of that? And the consequences of that are much more in the purview of the council's ability to make decisions on those impacts than the Planning Commission. So the applicant actually made some really strong arguments, got a good way path, almost convinced the Planning Commission, I believe, and in the end the Planning Commission realized this is beyond our scope, and by default they recommended or passed on a negative recommendation of the council. So the applicant will be looking to go to the council as soon as possible. That could be as early as August the 19th, but again, we would need to check agendas. We're not sure if we could be ready in time for that presentation.
Okay, Peter Barnes, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Bye.
Well, the Wasatch County Council meets tomorrow starting at 4 o'clock, and on the phone with a preview of the meeting, I have Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Leslie.
Let's see, taking a quick look at the agenda, the first reading of a new ordinance would establish a finance department. So what do you use now?
So Wasatch County currently uses our clerk auditor's office to process all of our finance. But what actually we're looking to do is to mimic what Summit County has been doing for years.
Okay, so if you've done without until now, why would you need it today?
So what it does is it just organizationally shifts the responsibilities from the existing clerk auditor's office into an administrative office. What this does is, I think, provides a level of consistency that we aren't seeing, you know, as new elected officials come in, changes in approaches to how we handle our finances. So by making it finance and administrative department, we feel like it's kind of future-proofing and ensuring that we have just a high level of quality and consistency in our financial operations.
Okay, I think you need to turn down your send buttons, I think, because you're hearing kind of echoing going on. Is that?
Yeah, I am hearing a little bit of echo. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I think it's on your side. I can't help you. So let's see. There's also a discussion and consideration of a resolution amending the policy on employee leave. So what's changing here?
What we're doing here is just a couple tweaks. One is that the state of Utah adopted some changes to how they handle leave, and we're looking to kind of mirror that primarily in our parental leave. So we're increasing our parental leave by one additional week for all parents, and then a further additional week for birth parents. So a woman who gives birth to a child, they'll now qualify for 3 and 6 weeks instead of 2 and 4 weeks.
All right. And any news on the progress of the administration building? I know you're going to be giving, you and the council be getting an update.
Yeah, it's actually going really well. We've kind of got through some of the difficult initial stages of identifying locations of utilities and things. So we're in the process of pouring foundations next. We're kind of wrapping up the footing stage, and we should start seeing it going vertical in the next few weeks.
All right, let's see. Preliminary municipalities, there have been some discussion of passing a resolution to oppose this pilot program. So what are the next steps here?
So the plan is right now next week to discuss with the council the resolution that would call for the repeal of the preliminary municipalities. We just don't think it's a good fit. And I think there's even an argument to be made that it's making affordable housing worse, not better.
All right. Any idea if the state will now allow for another applicant for a preliminary municipality now that the Bear Canyon proposal seems to be off the table?
Yeah, my understanding from the Lieutenant Governor's office is that they will go down their list to the next in line. I don't know that they have announced which preliminary municipality is the next in line. I think there's some concern that Wasatch County could be the third in line because we had another application for Smooth Hollow in the Wallsburg area that we hope isn't that next one.
So tell me a little bit more about that.
So the Smooth Hollow was an application for a preliminary municipality in the area. It was kind of, I think, south of Wallsburg. So this is kind of in that southwest portion of Wasatch County, closer to Utah County. So as far as I understand it, the Lieutenant Governor's office, every year they take the first and the second applications to process for these preliminary municipalities. Given that Bear Canyon is coming off, they'll go down to their list to whoever was the next.
All right. Any progress on hiring a county historian?
No, not yet. The historian's position is going to be placed in the library, and so we're working through some hiring in the library right now with some other positions, and so we wanted to make sure that we had appropriate resources on this recruitment. So it's still in progress.
All right, now the funding is already allocated. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of qualifications the county's looking for in a new historian?
Yeah, I think an ideal candidate would be somebody who has an education or training or background in, historical subject matters. What we really would love is just somebody who's really enthusiastic and can kind of lead out, because this is a new capacity for the county. You know, it's not something that we've done in the past, and we need someone to fill in the gaps of the things that we don't know that we don't know.
And how are you recruiting for the position?
Typically, the county goes through a number of resources. There are government, in particularly in the state of Utah, the League of Cities and Towns has a really good job board where most government positions are posted. Because this is new to us, we may be looking at some more novel approaches to how we try to attract and retain. We've actually had a number of people reach out to us expressing some level of interest and wanting to be involved in Wasatch County, some locals who have an interest in historical preservation in general.
And in terms of the new hires' priorities, do you have a list at this point?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things is we want to make sure that they're integrated to our administration building project, because in our lobby space, we're trying to integrate a lot of our own history into our new facility and kind of documenting what we currently have and coming up with ways to appropriately display that so that we can convey, you know, one of our core values is in stewardship, and we want to be good stewards of our history as much as we do of our physical environment. And preserving our heritage is a core part of our vision for our community.
All right. And you're also working on a memorandum of understanding with Heber City for the Northfields preservation. What are the county's must-haves in any revised agreement?
What we are looking to do is ensure that the existing boundaries of the Northfields, these are the parts that would be to the north and west of the lower portions that kind of skirt around Heber City. So we're 900 north, where the new Smith's line connects in. What we're hoping is that anything north and west of that stays basically similar to what its existing entitlements are. The city and the county have always agreed that that would basically be the case. And with the proposed bypass alignment, we wanted to clarify that the piece that is on the east side of that north connection up to Potter Lane would be still considered in the Northfields and not part of Heber City at some point in the future.
Okay, and other than that, any other differences then from the 2019 agreement?
No, those were the kind of limited scope. I think there is a general interest in a more robust cooperation in how we do open space preservation in general. And I think some opportunities there are partnerships and leveraging both entities' funding resources that include not just the open space bonds that Wasatch County has access to, but Heber City actually collects a fee for preservation through their their North Village annexation area. And the county also has access to Greenbelt rollback funds that can be used for preservation as well.
So what needs to happen to finalize then this new memorandum of understanding?
Really, it's just the political work of navigating the details. I think both entities are on board with the ideas and concept. It just comes down to what's the best way to approach them, what's the best way to codify those things. And so that's just talking between the two entities. So what we're doing is we're convening subcommittees of both of the councils and including staff in that so that we can work through those details.
All right. And then finally, the Senior Farmers Market Nutrition Program. This is a weekly effort to make fresh produce affordable and accessible for seniors in Wasatch County. How does it work?
You know, I'm not as familiar with that. We have a lot of really robust programs, and through our Senior Center, they do a lot of connecting to these resources, but that one I'm not very familiar with.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Dustin?
No, not this morning.
All right, thanks for your time. Well, since the COVID-19 pandemic's end, the number of Utahns working from home has steadily declined. As KPCW's Christine Weller reports, Summit and Wasatch counties have higher work-from-home rates compared to the rest of the state.
Newly released data from the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute shows work-from-home rates in the Beehive State are declining. After nearly tripling between 2019 and 2021 due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the report shows the number of Utahns working from home began to decline in 2022. According to the report, this follows national trends. In 2024, 15.7% of Utahns worked from home, down from 20% in 2021. Lead author Heidi Pryor said that means about 50,000 Utahns who were working from home have returned to the office.
even with that happening, we still see really elevated rates of working from home in the state compared to what was happening in 2019. We have twice as many home-based workers today.
Summit County had the second highest work-from-home rate between 2020 and 2024, with around 20% of residents working from home. Paiute and Wayne counties came in first and third, respectively. Other rural counties followed. Wasatch, Kane, and Rich counties had an 18 to 19.9% work-from-home rate, which is similar to counties along the Wasatch Front.
Most of the counties that have higher work-from-home rates are near an urban area. Counties that are incredibly rural tend to have lower work-from-home rates. Summit and Wasatch counties, that fits.
Pryor said Summit County's high home-based workforce may be due in part to having a higher percentage of residents with bachelor's degrees. Over 23% of Utah workers with bachelor's degrees worked from home in 2024. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, almost 60% of people 25 and older in Summit County had a bachelor's degree or more education between 2020 and 2024. That's compared to 51% in Wasatch County, 39% in Salt Lake County, and 13% in Paiute County. Having high earners may also be a factor. Almost 23% of Utah workers earning $75,000 or more annually worked from home in 2024, and Summit County had a median income of $138,000 from 2020 to 2024. Wasatch County had a median income of almost $118,000. Salt Lake and Paiute County sat at $97,500 and $48,000, respectively. Pryor said the report also shows rates vary widely by occupation. Healthcare, production, construction, and maintenance jobs don't have home-based options. Fewer than 1 in 10 government employees now work from home, compared to 1 in 3 in 2021. Credit authorizers, loan clerks, and private investigators, on the other hand, have the highest work-from-home rates.
A lot of jobs that have to do with computers or math have had work-from-home rates go up. Positions where the bulk of someone's work are done, you know, like on a screen and on the phone, have stuck with working from home.
Pryor said demographics also informed work-from-home trends. Between 2021 and 2024, the rate of non-citizens working from home was cut in half, going down to 7%. In contrast, Utahns who were citizens at birth worked from home more than twice as much, with 16% having home-based jobs.
And the interesting thing is that non-citizens saw their work-from-home rate drop a lot, but people who are naturalized citizens, who became citizens later in life, did not experience that. Something about having that piece of legal status does seem to make a difference.
Non-Hispanic, white, and Asian workers had higher work-from-home rates compared to other racial and ethnic groups, with over 15% based at home. Find the full report at kpcw.org. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
On the phone now with an update from the Summit Land Conservancy, I have CEO Cheryl Fox. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Let's begin with some news that came out last week about protecting the East Hoytsville Range.
Yes, we were very excited to get that project across the finish line. This is a 2,800-acre working ranch just to the east of Hoytsville. And this family has been incredibly patient. Something got stuck in the federal approval system, and it took about 18 months to get it unstuck. But we did eventually get it unstuck, and the family was, again, very patient. We were fortunate, I think, that we had some really dedicated, hardworking federal employees. We actually even called in support from Blake Moore's office to see if we couldn't solve the problem. And finally, we did. So that is finished. The family is poised to do another 3,900-acre easement. And then there are a number of additional ranches that touch these pieces that, again, we already have letters of intent with and are working forward. So in the end, we'll protect quite a big swath of rangeland there east of Hoytsville and Wanship. We're pretty excited about that.
Yeah, and it sounds like this marks a milestone for you in the For the Future campaign.
Yes, it does. Since we launched the For the Future campaign in 2023, our goal was to protect more land and protect it faster. And so in just the last 3 years, we've protected over 15,000 acres through this initiative. And, you know, moving our, I guess it's our 16th easement project in that period of time. So, you know, we're very excited about that. And I'll just say that, you know, it takes time to get these things up and running and through the process. So when we started in 2023, we thought, all right, well, we have a couple of 4 or 5 projects out there. But now we have about 5 or 6 easement projects, more than that, to close just this year. So I signed papers yesterday for another 4,800 acre project that, again, we've submitted to the federal government for final funding. Just many more projects coming down the path. We're excited about that. And that really is the result of individuals who support our work.
Okay. Let's see. You've got a number of upcoming events. Why don't you walk us through those?
Yes, we do. We are coming into the last of the hops hikes of the season. That will be August 5th, tomorrow. It's on Prospect Ridge, and which is the most sort of demanding of all of the hops hikes. But it'd be great if people want to come out and see how the hops are doing. It was fortunate that we had so much rain in July. We don't know exactly when the hops harvest is going to be this year. And so if people want to participate in these, they need to sign up on our website, which is wesaveland.org. Go to the happenings page. You can sign up for the hikes and get on the mailing list for the harvest. We will have Hoppy Hour at Offset Beer on September 24th. We're looking forward to that. Hoppy Offset Beer has stepped in and agreed to play with the wild hops. It's always a challenge because the brewmaster never knows exactly what the quality of those hops, what the taste and the flavor is going to be. So it's like trying to cook something with an ingredient that you're not real sure of. So we're excited that they're willing to give that a go. We also have Mindful Mondays on August 10th and 24th, which is kind of getting out in the open space and doing something a little bit different. August 10th is a Pilates class, and August 24th is a calming, slow, mindful walk. And then we have a moonshine adventure on August 27th out at McPolland Farms, and this is going to be a photography session during the golden hour. So, again, these are limited events because we just can't have 50 people out on the trail all at once. So go to wesaveland.org to sign up for these things.
Okay. Let's see. Anything else you wanted to mention? Oh, you had your fundraiser at the end of July. How did that go for you?
We had the Blue Sky Bash version 2026 on last Friday night. You know, something really magical happens. We have been fortunate to be hosted at the ranch at Blue Sky for many, many years. We were able to give Mike and Barb Phillips, who are our hosts up there, a little bit of a thank you gift and honor their support for all of this time. And you know, it's a magical evening. We have our friends from Hawkwatch who come and they bring a bald eagle and an owl and an amazing hawk. And so during the cocktail hour, people mingle and talk to these raptors, or at least learn about these raptors. And I just think it creates a really terrific community of people who understand the importance of open space and understand how their individual gifts are, you know, leveraged 10 times, and how we're poised to do so much more conservation. So it was a very successful event. A sparkly jacket changed hands, and we have a new sparkly jacket owner. So grateful for everybody who came, for our board and staff who rallied around and put on a great event, and especially for our hosts and all of our wonderful sponsors. You know, goodness, Park City Mountain Vale Epic Promise really supercharged our events. Bill White and his amazing teepee dinners. It was a terrific party.
Yeah. So what's the sparkly jacket story?
The sparkly jacket is a tuxedo jacket in rainbow sequins, and a person wore it to a bash about 5 years ago, and our auctioneer took one look at it and said, hey, can we auction that off? And so we did that first year, and then the winner brought it back, and it's been auctioned off now, I think, 5 times. So it's not just a sparkly jacket. It is a legacy for open space.
Okay. All right. And I guess looking ahead, there's some save the dates.
That's right. We will be participating with the Just Serve Volunteer Day. That's coming up on September, I think it's the 18th. It's a Saturday. And that will be... if people want to volunteer from that, we're going to be building One Rock Dams in Round Valley. Sorry, it is September 19th. We're excited about that. We'll be at Snowbirds Oktoberfest for some of those, the 12th and 13th. And then our staff is going to the National Land Trust Alliance Conference in September. So, yeah, lots going on.
Okay. Cheryl, anything
and
else?
We should be closing three more easements in August. So, again, I can't say it often enough, but that is when people make contributions, that is what it allows us to do. So, yeah.
Okay.
More conservation on the way.
Thank you, Cheryl. Well, the founder of Dakota Pacific Real Estate is also a donor to Utah's embattled Senate leader. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports Stuart Adams lost the June primary election and later collected thousands of dollars.
Utah Senate President Stuart Adams, a latent Republican, collected $25,000 from John Miller about 1 month after the primary. Miller is the founder of Dakota Pacific Real Estate, now Six Ridge Partners, which is soon to break ground on a controversial mixed-use development in Kimball Junction. He leads the company's investment arm, Dakota Pacific Holdings. Campaign contributions Adams received from Miller and others after the June 23rd primary election totaled almost $120,000. The amount was first reported by Utah Political Watch. Adams lost the GOP primary in Utah's Senate District 7. Widely considered one of the state's most powerful politicians, he will leave the legislature at the end of this year. Utah Political Watch reports he may still have outstanding campaign bills, but those would not be public until late September. Utah law restricts how politicians can spend campaign donations. They cannot make personal purchases, for example, but they can sit on the cash until the next campaign season and spend it then. Adams hasn't said publicly what his political future holds. Since 2008, he has served on the board of the Military Installation Development Authority and is its current chair, his term expiring in March 2027. MIDA is the state entity driving development at Deer Valley Resort's East Village base, and it has partnered with celebrity investor Kevin O'Leary on a controversial data center near the north end of the Great Salt Lake. Political commentators have speculated that backlash from that data center fueled Adams' primary defeat. Utah Political Watch also noted that Adams received $25,000 July 21st from Gary Barnett, the head of Extel Development, which is building most of East Village. Another East Village landholder, Dallas-based Dart Industries, donated $10,000. Earlier this year, Adams' Political Action Committee received $25,000 each from Barnett and his wife and Sky Ridge owner Tyler Aldous and his wife. Sky Ridge is part of MIDA's Wasatch County project area and has collaborated with it on infrastructure development. In 2022, Barnett's wife and John Miller each gave the Adams Leadership PAC $5,000. That was a year before Summit County sued Dakota Pacific and lawmakers, claiming they had engaged in unconstitutional legislative cronyism. The now-dismissed lawsuit accused the company Miller founded of using its connections at the Utah Capitol to circumvent local planning processes and get its development approved. The county and developer have since partnered to expand the Kimball Junction Transit Center and other nonprofit and civic facilities in the area. Adams did not respond to KPCW's email seeking comment Monday. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
And both the Heber City and Midway Councils are set to discuss affordable housing projects tonight. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has an overview of what's under construction.
Wasatch County's two largest municipalities are each pushing for more workforce housing in the valley. The Heber City Council is revisiting plans for Celebration, a multi-phase project near Wasatch High School. City Manager Matt Brower says different shares of the units will be designated for different income levels. At a meeting Tuesday, the council will focus on specifics of the agreement between the developer and the city.
Phase one consists of 148 units, all of them affordable, between 40% and 80% AMI. And it's just walking through the terms of the agreement to see if it's acceptable to the city.
AMI is area median income. For Wasatch County, a family of four making between $54,000 and $109,000 would qualify for Celebration housing. Rents would vary based on the size of the apartment and the tenant's income. To support the development, Heber City will consider deferring $3.2 million in impact fees.
They'll be paid back to the city in 9 to 12 years at a 4% interest, but that's the first time the city's done anything like that.
Celebration is on the work session agenda, meaning the council will not make any final decisions about the plans Tuesday. The discussion begins at 5 p.m. in the Heber City Council chambers. In neighboring Midway, the City Council intends to vote on a development agreement to construct 6 workforce housing units on Main Street. The proposal includes 5 basement studio apartments and a 1-bedroom, with rent and utilities set between $1,200 and $1,400 per month. The apartments would remain affordable for 20 years. The developer is asking Midway to waive building permit fees and lease the water rights for the project. The Midway City Council meeting begins at 6 p.m. Tuesday in the Community Center. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.